Welcome to the inaugural Wisconsin Lawyers Chapters Conference. Thank you all very much for being here with us today. My name is Rob Driscoll. I am the president of the Milwaukee Lawyers Chapter, which, along with the Madison Lawyers Chapter, is the host of today's conference. For those of you who are maybe new to the Federalist Society, just a bit of background about the organization. It's a nationwide organization which boasts of more than 60,000 members in its lawyers division and has chapters in 80 different cities across the country. The student division has 10,000 members and chapters at all, maybe or most, of the ABA accredited law schools, plus chapters at other organizations, including some undergraduate institutions across the country as well. The society was first founded in 1982. The purpose then, as now, was to promote legal debate across all sectors of the legal profession and to promote principles such as the separation of powers and the proper role of the judiciary in a free society. Specifically, as regards to the judiciary, that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is and not what it should be. The society, however, is nonpartisan. It takes no positions on matters of public policy. It does not advocate for positions in court, and it does not endorse candidates for elected office. The varied views that you'll hear today from our tremendous group of panelists are those are their own and not those of the society. A conference like this doesn't come together very easily and not without a lot of volunteer hours being put into it. And I think those volunteers deserve a little bit of recognition as we start. Both chapters had a number of members who volunteered right at the beginning to serve on a couple of committees, and I wanted to recognize those individuals. So let me read their names, and then we can finish off with a round of applause. They were Justice Rebecca Bradley, Judge Brian Hagedorn, Professor Ryan Owens, Daniel Sir, Tim Lundquist, Carl Dahlin, and Corden Fish. So if you can join me in thanking them with a round of applause. Now, there are two other individuals that we need to thank as well, and they come from the national organization, Lisa Azell and Kate Fugate. Lisa, you've seen right here. She's right here in the front, and Kate has been working the table. Without them, this absolutely would not have happened. They did just the lion's share of the detailed work on this and brought their experience and, most importantly, their patience with us. So if we could thank them as well, I appreciate it. In September 1859, a rising lawyer from Illinois made his way to Milwaukee. The occasion was an agricultural fair put on by the Wisconsin State Agricultural Society at a site in Milwaukee that is incidentally now owned by Milwaukee or by Marquette University. Just over a year away from being elected president, Abraham Lincoln used his time in front of that group to discuss such scintillating topics as the importance of developing a steam plow to aid in the production of agriculture in the country, and also his views as to the relationship between capital and labor, a timely topic given that the Communist Manifesto had been published just 10 years before. His talk is really not well known to history. It's certainly not a masterpiece of oratory like the Gettysburg Address or the Second Inaugural, but his opening paragraph is what interests me the most. He quietly expressed a thought in that opening paragraph that's all the more interesting because of its proximity to the Civil War, which, again, was just over a year away. Speaking of the fair, he said, "They bring us together and thereby make us better acquainted and better friends than we otherwise would be. They make more pleasant and more strong and more durable the bond of social and political union among us." About a year before that, Lincoln had expressed a similar sentiment at a 4th of July celebration, finding those celebrations to be a common tie among citizens, taking us back to the Declaration of Independence, what he would later call in the same talk an electric cord. He said, "We go from these meetings in better humor with ourselves. We feel more attached the one to the other and more firmly bound to the country we inhabit. In every way, we are better men in the age and race and country in which we live for these celebrations." Both of these insights were characteristically Lincolnian, expressing abstract truths in plain terms using unremarkable examples. This conference and the others across the country like it are descendants of those gatherings that Lincoln found so important 160 years ago. They are opportunities to gauge in the open and spirited debate and the exchange of ideas that is both a benefit of a free society and its necessary precondition. For without that exchange, we are not only in a worse humor with one another, but we deprive ourselves of the opportunity to better understand both our own principles and those of our fellow citizens. As Lincoln's 19th century contemporary Alexis de Tocqueville wrote, when the right of every citizen to share in the government of society is acknowledged, everyone must be presumed to be able to choose between the various opinions of his contemporaries and to appreciate the different facts from which those inferences may be drawn. I differ with the Frenchman on one point only, that it is not only a presumption, but a duty. And I'm glad that we are able to fulfill our duty here today. So again, welcome to the inaugural conference. Thank you for your participation. And I hope you leave here too with the bonds of social and political union at least a little bit stronger for having attended. Thank you.
Thank you for that very good introduction, and thanks everyone for coming out on this rainy Friday to see this conference. The first panel today is First Amendment controversies, free speech, and religious liberty. We have four distinguished speakers. They're each going to speak for 12 minutes on a topic related to the subject. They will have each panelist will have an opportunity to kind of address the remarks given by their fellow panelists. I will then take moderator privilege to ask the first question or two, and then we'll open it up for the audience. This is my first time moderating a panel. I've been on panels a good bit for Federal Society and otherwise. It's kind of two ways you can introduce the speakers. You can either do all of their bios first, or you can do the bio, then they speak, and I'm going to do the second, because I sometimes you hear four bios in a row at the beginning, and you kind of, your mind drifts away. So I'm going to give each speaker's bio, and then they'll speak, and then I'll give the next speaker's bio, and they'll speak. So first speaker today is Professor Howard Schorber, who is a professor at UW here in Madison within the Political Science Department. Professor Schorber is also a core faculty member of the UW Legal Studies program. From 2011 to 2013, he was visiting professor at Nazarbayev, did I say that correct?
Close enough.
University in Kazakhstan. In 2012, he was the Australian Fulbright Distinguished Chair in American politics. He has authored several books, including Democracy and Authenticity, The Language of Liberal Constitutionalism, The Creation of American Common Law, Speech, Conduct, and the First Amendment. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you. So I'm really touched, because in one of the books that was just mentioned, I actually have a section where I discuss Abraham Lincoln's attachment to steam-powered farm implements. And this is the first time I've ever heard that reference by anyone else. And so I just thank you. It's actually quite an important theme. Lincoln believed that technology, particularly railroads and telegraphs, would bring us together as a single nation by allowing strangers and people who live a great distance to communicate. In fact, Jefferson, much earlier, went through a similar an evolution in his own thinking, which he largely abandoned his attachment to the idea of the yeoman farmer and the need for local community in his belief that the growth of early, this is about 1820 or so, railroad technology would make us all one people with one conversation. Today, of course, the internet binds us together into a single group of shared values. It all worked, is my point. All right. Each of us has a somewhat different role on this panel. Mine is to belabor the obvious. I'm hoping to be able to belabor some obvious points in at least slightly interesting ways. I'm keenly aware that with this audience, the last thing I need to do is recite basic elements of constitutional law or precedents. So I'll speak in very broad strokes. If I say something that seems to require defense or explication, I'm more than happy to provide that afterwards. I want to talk about the way in which both our broad understanding of free speech and our broad understanding of religious liberty has gone through quite a sharp change. And periodizing this change is a little bit difficult because they're not perfectly coterminous. But in both cases, there's a very clear sort of early period and more modern period. And I want to suggest, this is the potentially provocative part, that the more difficult controversies that we face today arise in part because we haven't worked out what this new regime, this new jurisprudential regime, looks like. Before I dig into that, a couple of very quick observations that we really need to keep in mind when we have discussions like these. One is that when we talk about constitutional issues, we have a tendency to forget that anything else exists. Well, not we, some of us. Okay, I do, all right? That is, confronted by a First Amendment question, I think only about the First Amendment. But of course, there are whole complex bodies of law, federal and state law, that also have to do with how rights can be exercised and defined in actual practice. And I'll give you one obvious example. In teaching First Amendment, or talking publicly about First Amendment, one of the classic things to say is that provocative speech is protected. And you start talking about heckler's vetoes, and how no matter how provocative an idea is, you know, we are obliged to treat it with toleration and so on. And as a constitutional statement, that's absolutely fine. It's also true, however, that provocative speech can be a defense to murder. So you have a constitutional right to engage in speech, but someone else may have a legal right to kill you for it. That's a somewhat nuanced right that I just described right there. Under an appropriate circumstance, provocative speech may constitute the intentional infliction of outrageous emotional distress, for which you can be sued and large amounts of your wealth and property can be taken away. So again, sure, it's constitutionally protected. That doesn't mean you have immunity from all the legal consequences. I really like that ringtone.
There'll be no consequence
later
for that.
Secondly, and this is perhaps the most obvious, you know, talk about belaboring the obvious, this is really getting carried away, but in the context of free speech and religious liberty in particular, it's sometimes worth reminding ourselves that calling something a right includes the recognition that no rights are absolute or simply defined. And I don't mean this part to be provocative at all. Any number of simple examples, no one has ever suggested that the right of free speech protects my right to say, give me your wallet or I'll shoot you. Nor to engage in blackmail, nor revealing the state secrets, nor about 1,000 other categories that we all know of areas in which engaging in speech is not a protected activity, right? And the same goes for religious liberty. Long ago, there was an attempt by someone to argue that my religion, which I've only recently discovered, prohibits me from paying taxes. And the court said, nah, we're not going to buy that, nor human sacrifice, nor any number of other things. Right? Third observation. And again, I almost feel I should apologize for how obvious this is, although I think in a moment it'll become a little bit clear that it's less obvious. That which is not, there's a difference constitutionally between what is obliged and what is permitted. And the fact that the Constitution doesn't require something does not mean that it requires its opposite, and does not mean that it does not permit that which is not required. All right, with all that wildly elementary background. So, the old regime, as I'm describing it, of religious liberty constitutional doctrine, which starts in the 1940s and goes roughly to, just let's say, the 1980s, was based on a premise that religion is a special case, specially dangerous and specially valuable, and therefore religion must be shielded from politics and from the state, and the state and politics must be shielded from the effects of religion. And in the context of both free exercise and establishment, this largely played out in terms of the question of incidentals, incidental benefits and incidental burdens. And in those days, the courts were very careful to avoid incidental benefits and incidental burdens. You can think of lots of instances of this sort of thing, but the most obvious ones. So the Free Exercise Clause was understood to prohibit, or at least to impose a strict scrutiny standard of review on incidental burdens on free exercise. That's Sherbert. If you look at cases leading up to Lemon, there's all this discussion about things like entanglement and the concern about incidental benefits. And the idea was that unlike in other areas of constitutional jurisprudence, in the areas of, because religion was such a special case, there would be extra efforts made both to shield the machinery of the state, as it was called in Grendel's Den versus Larkin, from use by religious entities, and conversely, to protect religious practices, religious institutions, from intrusion by the state. So, for example, just again, I know this is elementary, but recall that part of the issue of entanglement in Lemon was that in order to allow the funding to go forward as had been described without running afoul of Establishment Clause considerations, it would be necessary for government agencies to exercise scrutiny over the activities of a religious school, and it was the necessity of that scrutiny, not the fact of the benefit, but the necessity of that close interaction between government agents and a religious school that caused the court to say this would be unacceptable. That was the whole entanglement idea. In that period, where questions were asked having to do with religious liberty, the intellectual tension at work was the tension between the requirements of the Establishment Clause and the requirements of the Free Exercise Clause. And the kinds of questions that were asked were, if we allow too much in the way of special prerogatives for religious practice, do we risk giving the state's imprimatur to an establishment? If we allow too much in the way of the state establishing or acting toward establishment of religion, does that have the effect of interfering with the free exercise of religion by those who are from a different, who are adherents to a different community? And those were that intellectual tension was the terrain on which the debate was carried out. On the speech side, the old regime was essentially one of categories, increasingly sharply drawn categories, in particular sharp distinctions between protected and unprotected speech, very formally defined, and sharp distinctions between speech and expressive conduct. So the rules for regulation of expressive conduct were very, very different from the rules regarding expression of speech per se. If a law was not directed at the expression itself, but only at the conduct elements, then it was likely to be fine. And that's O'Brien, zoning laws, right, any number of other cases in which expressive conduct was at issue. And within those two terrains of intellectual debate, free speech and freedom of religion did not very often overlap. I know, for example, that Professor Eisenberg will refer to Barnett, right? That's one of the cases you'll talk about. Barnett is a famous case involving a student who was a Jehovah's Witness who objected to being required to recite the Pledge of Allegiance. I won't try and say any more because I'm sure you'll want to profile in some particular way. The only point I wanted to mention is that that case was not a religion case. The student's objections were religious, but it was decided solely on free speech grounds, and particularly on the idea that compelled speech is not permissible. The words under God were not part of the pledge in those days, and the fact that the student's objections were grounded in his religion was not part of the analysis. I mentioned that at the moment, again, this issue will be dealt with in much more depth in a moment. My interest in mentioning that is just to point out that in this earlier period, the terrain of debate about religious freedom and the terrain of debate about free expression were largely, not entirely, but largely separate. What about the more modern era in both cases? Well, on the religion side, the giant change is that religion is simply treated much less as a special case, less protected, and less to be protected against in both directions. Of course, on the free exercise side, the most famous case is Smith, Justice Scalia's ruling in his majority opinion that there is no constitutional obligation to grant exceptions to generally applicable law for religious practice and no heightened level of scrutiny that is triggered by such an incidental burden. As Justice Scalia said in that opinion, this does naturally imply that in a democracy, majority religions will receive more accommodation than minority religions, but that, he said, is the inescapable cost of living in a democracy. Right? So drastically reducing the extent to which we think of freedom of religious practice as something shielded against democratic politics, and quite explicitly, in Scalia's words, making it part of a legitimate subject of democratic politics. It was a very controversial opinion. I believe it's controversial to this day. I think it's a fair statement. But certainly as an indicator of a shift in the treatment of religion as a special topic, its implications were stark and remain so. Agostini, in which the court abandoned the whole entanglement idea, simply saying that there's no need for the state to ensure that its accommodation of free exercise does not slip into establishment. And since there's no need to ensure that against that danger through surveillance, there's no need for entanglement. The specific context has to do with teachers, but more generally that we will not be concerned about a secondary consequence of entanglement between the state and religion. There's no need for such a sharp division. And Zelman. And of course, there are lots of other cases, but right, indirect benefits in the form of public support don't raise Establishment Clause questions. Not that they raise the questions, we'll decide them differently, don't raise them at all. An intervening private choice means there is no constitutional issue. Now, I am not trying to argue that any of these are good or bad outcomes, or better or worse than the rules that came before, but they're different. They're radically different, and intellectually. And the radical change is that religion is simply not as much a special case as it was before. It's much more treated as... Is that how much time I have left?
A minute left.
Fortunately, I can talk very fast. I'll try. On the speech side, the sharp division of categories has been blurred and broken down in multiple ways. We can think about RAV, for example, the idea that there is no sharp distinction between protected and unprotected categories of speech if there's a potential issue of viewpoint discrimination. The idea, perhaps shown most clearly in campaign finance context, that expressive conduct and pure speech are not different. They will be treated synonymously. Obviously, under the O'Brien sort of understanding, a rule that applies to all campaign finance activities of a certain type is not aimed at the content of the expression, it's aimed at the conduct of spending money, but that distinction has been abandoned in that context and in many others. So you can think of the negative association cases like Dale, which again, previously have been decided under a regime that said association is a form of expressive conduct, is only very narrowly protected. It has to be a very particular kind of association with very particular characteristics. In Dale, the court said, no, that's not true. Association is expressive conduct, which is just like speech, and it all becomes a form of compelled speech. I'm simplifying dramatically, but I have 30 seconds left. So what I want to suggest, and I could have suggested better if I had just 5 more minutes, is that in the current terrain, the reason for this conference, for this discussion, is that we do now have direct tension between principles of free speech and religious practice in ways that did not, that we were sort of shielded from under an earlier intellectual regime. And we have not yet worked out the boundaries of our new categories. If expressive conduct is exactly the same as speech, is all expressive conduct equivalently the same as speech, right? Or is some expressive conduct more expressive than others? Now that we've abandoned the sharp distinction between laws directed at expression and laws directed at conduct, we're going to need some other way to distinguish cases. If religious exemptions are not required but are permitted and left to the democratic process, is there any point at which granting too much accommodation to majority religions while denying them to minority religions raises some sort of equal protection issue, independent of the older doctrines that we had about religious accommodation, right? And you can, I think you will see as you listen to the following discussions how many of the conundra with which we find ourselves faced today are articulable in this new, or relatively new, my lifetime anyway, intellectual framework of thinking about religious liberty and free speech in ways they would not have been prior to the 1980s. And I'm done.
That's a great segue to the next.
That was it.
Talk. Thank you so much, Professor, for those remarks. Our next remarks will be from Professor Rick Essenberg, who is the founder, president, and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute of Law and Liberty, a law and public policy organization headquartered in Milwaukee. Formerly on the faculty of Marquette University Law School, his scholarship has appeared in publications such as the Harvard Law Review, Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy, Wake Forest Law Review, and William and Mary Bill of Rights Journal. Thank you, Professor.
Well, thank you. This is an auspicious occasion, the inaugural conference of the Wisconsin chapters of the Federalist Society. I've always been particularly heartened by the rejuvenation of the Madison chapter of the Federalist Society. A couple of years ago, when you all got started again, I think I spoke at one of your early luncheons, and it was at the Madison Club, and I came here to Dane County, and the room was full. The room was full of lawyers who were willing to come to a Federalist Society event. And I remember making a joke that I felt like Abraham might have felt had he been able to tell the Lord that there were 10 righteous men in Sodom. And I include in this category of righteous men and women those people like my friend and occasional nemesis Lester Pines. who are at every Federalist Society, a major Federalist Society event, and are willing to engage in a civil discourse about issues on which we profoundly disagree. And I think the willingness of folks to do that is to be commended, and that is a clever segue, very clever, I think, into my remarks today. Now, I ran into Justice Bradley before we started today, and she said, "Well, you know, are you going to talk about, you know, something before the court? Because if you are, then, you know, Justice Kelly and I will have to excuse ourselves." And I said, "Well, no, I'm not going to talk about cases or the law or anything like that. This is what we call in the opinion business a thumb sucker. And that is, I want to talk about what I think are some broad themes that touch upon our consideration of both freedom of speech and religious liberty. And the core principle, the core case that I want to turn to, however, to have that conversation is West Virginia State Board of Education versus Barnett. Now, you'll remember that case from...
Sorry.
Yeah, it was amazing. You'll remember that case, the West Virginia Board of Education in January of 1942 passed a requirement that school children must recite the Pledge of Allegiance. They must be made to say it. Now, from a distance of 76 years, we can think of this as sort of, you know, xenophobic, faux patriotic overreaching. But think of what was happening at the time. Right? This law was passed in the wake of Pearl Harbor. The outcome of the Second World War was far from assured. We were in the process of losing the Philippines and experiencing the Bataan Death March. And it was thought that it was essential to national survival to inculcate in school children a sense of national unity and purpose that would be required for the sacrifices that the coming years would require. But yet, the United States Supreme Court said that West Virginia had gone too far, that these students could not be compelled, they could not be made to say something that they did not believe. And in one of the most stirring passages in our constitutional jurisprudence, Justice Jackson wrote, "If there is any fixed star in our constitutional constellation, it is that no official, high or petty, can prescribe what shall be orthodox in politics, nationalism, religion, or other matters of opinion, or force citizens to confess by word or act their faith therein." Now, you know, people have nibbled around the edges of what Justice Jackson said. They've questioned whether that was really empirically accurate or not, and there certainly are exceptions to everything. I agree with Professor Schraber that, you know, rights are not absolute. But the fact of the matter is that as a legal, as a doctrinal matter, we have extended extraordinary protection to freedom of speech and religious liberty. Extraordinary even in comparison to that afforded by other Western democracies, where people can be prosecuted, they can get in trouble for saying the wrong thing, simply for saying the wrong thing. And I believe that this robust protection is rooted not only in a confidence in the marketplace of ideas, that if we permit free exchange, we permit free speech, if we permit people to follow their religious lights. I'm not eliding the doctrinal distinction between, you know, freedom of speech and freedom of religion, but I want to talk about some underlying concepts. It certainly is rooted in that. It's rooted in Justice Brandeis's famous formulation in Whitney versus California, where he said if there is still time to correct error through education, through speech, that more speech rather than enforced silence is the remedy. But it's not only rooted in that. It's also rooted, I think, in a form of epistemic humility about the ability of any institution or any majority to determine what is right or what is wrong, and the desirability and the possibility of imposing that determination upon any one of us, that that to do that is not only futile, but dangerous, that it will lead to a war of all against all. And in another famous phrase of Justice Jackson, the unity that we achieve will be the unity of the graveyard. And so this has been, you know, part of our constitutional DNA, but it's been hard, and we've never been consistent about it. There's always been an evil that we sought to eradicate. I mean, it used to be communism, right? It used to be people who dissented in the time of war, and this led to bad decisions, I think. United States versus Schenck, Dennis versus United States in the late 50s. So it's not an uncheckered commitment, or not an commitment that we've always followed consistently, but it has been a commitment, and I think it's still the case that at least when we're talking about things which are clearly expressive conduct, that the courts have been relatively staunch in protecting these things. I think recently of the case versus Mattel versus Mattel versus Tam, right? And this was a case where the issue before the court was, can you use the disparagement clause of the Lanham Act, which says that, you know, you can't, a trademark can't disparage people or groups of people. And the question was whether or not that clause could be used to deny a trademark to an Asian rock band that decided that they were going to sort of take ownership of a racial slur and call themselves the Slants. And the court ruled unanimously that it would be unconstitutional to deny them registration under the Lanham Act. Now, they didn't agree on a rationale. There were four justices. Justice Alito wrote for a group of four that said that even if you consider this commercial speech, that preventing offensive language is not a legitimate state purpose. And then there was Justice Kennedy, who wrote for another group, and he said that that this constitutes viewpoint discrimination and cannot stand. And so I think that our current court is still very, very strong on First Amendment issues. But the other day in Green Bay, we hosted an event, and our speaker was David French. And lo and behold, David was making the same points about Burnett that I intended to make today, but unfortunately, fortunately for me, none of you heard him. He did it better. But one of the questions he asked that hadn't occurred to me, and I'm not going to ask this question and ask you to raise your hands for fear that the results will contradict the point that I'm trying to make, but he said that notwithstanding the fact that the First Amendment generally wins, do you feel today that you are more free to speak your mind than you were 10 years ago? And this group of people up in Green Bay overwhelmingly raised their hands and they said, no, we're not. And why is that? It's not because of the law. And the point that David was trying to make is that we don't have, it's not clear that we have a cultural appreciation for robust protection of freedom of speech. We don't have it on the left, and I don't think we have it on the right. Now, you know, we see things like, you know, we talk, you know, the obvious thing now is to sort of pivot towards, the controversies on campus about safe places and things like that, and that certainly is part of the conversation. But we also see it in the corporate world, where there are certain points of view, certain types of expression that are thought not only to be wrong, but so wrong that they must be subject to what is now a familiar ritual of public shaming and dissociation, right? And we see this periodically when somebody says something which often incorrectly is thought to be outside the bounds of civil discourse because it is insufficiently appreciative of diversity and inclusivity. But we also see it in, and I've noticed, in, and I actually am a religious reader of the New York Times.
Professor, one minute.
1 minute. And we see people, academics like Ulrich Bader and Professor Park from UCLA saying things like the ACLU should rethink this First Amendment stuff. And that in fact, and Bader wrote, and this is not an unfair characterization of his piece in the Times, that censorship is free speech, that the way that we advance freedom of speech for minorities is to censor speech, which is thought to get in the way of that. So if Ronald Reagan said that freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction, I think it's appropriate for us to be concerned about this. And I think that there are two cases in the current term of the court, the Masterpiece Baker's case and the California case regarding requirements that certain information be provided at crisis pregnancy centers that raise many of these issues. And I don't have time to talk about it, but I wasn't going to talk about it because Jordan Lawrence is going to talk about it, and he's worked on them, and he knows a lot more about them than I do. But I would suggest one thing as I end here is that I think to a substantial case, these cases which are said to be about discrimination and consumer protection are really about sending a message that certain points of view are impermissible, that some official, both high and petty, is attempting to dictate what is orthodox. And the question is, are we going to stand up like Justice Jackson did in Barnett at a time of grave national peril, or will we let the exigencies of the moment override our commitment to freedom of speech and freedom of conscience?
Thank you, Professor. Next, we're going to hear from Lester Pines. He is a senior partner at a law firm that bears his name here in Madison, a fellow of the American College of Trial Lawyers. He is a respected civil and criminal litigator and appellate advocate. In his over 40 years of practice, he has appeared in trial and appellate courts throughout Wisconsin and at the federal level. He was recently honored by the publication Best Lawyers in America as Madison's Lawyer of the Year in Criminal Defense White Collar. Thank you, Lester.
Thank you for that introduction. I wanted to share one thing with you about my resume. I am a senior partner at Pines Bach. A couple of years ago, I did a deposition of a senior partner at a law firm in Pittsburgh, and I said to him, "What does that mean, senior partner?" He said, "It means you have a lot of gray hair." I said, "Well, I guess I can't qualify then because I don't have any hair." My initials are LP. I'm not here as liberal panelist.
We kind of are, though.
The interesting thing about the panel is that we had one conference call to generally talk about generally organize the topics that we were going to address, but none of us actually shared with the other what it was that we were specifically going to address. Although I had said I wanted to talk about the concept of sincerely held religious beliefs. But I want to expand on what I want to address, to talk about generally how I perceive the courts within the context of the culture and the court's interaction with the culture and how that is somewhat problematic in the way that free speech and religious liberty issues are addressed. So let me take a step back and just give a little overview of what I think is happening culturally. And what in my lifetime has been happening at a very rapid rate. And that is, and I was born in 1950, I know it's hard to believe, but I was born in 1950, so I came of age in the 60s, I've been practicing law since the early 70s, and I can talk about the enormous cultural change that has happened in my lifetime. When I was a young boy, who I grew up in a traditional family where my mother was a homemaker, my father worked and supported the family, and the idea of my mother going to work was anathema. My father would never have ever considered my mother going to work. It was very traditional family structure, and I've seen that change dramatically. I've seen the movement for women's rights have an enormous impact on society. When I grew up in St. Louis, I didn't even know how segregated St. Louis was. But I've seen how de jure segregation was eliminated, how that has been a rapid change, how the way we treat Down syndrome people, who when I was a child were institutionalized, how that has changed, how the number of religious minorities that are part of our culture, particularly since the immigration law changes in 1965, has really been remarkable. Not to mention the number of different kinds of ethnic restaurants that exist that didn't exist before. For example, when I came to Madison in 1968, there were two Chinese restaurants here. One of them served white bread. This is just a little picture of what's gone on in the last, in my case, almost 70 years. There's been dramatic cultural change. There's been dramatic change with regard to sexual mores. There's been dramatic change with regard to the acceptance of gay, lesbian, and transgendered people. All of those things are in the mix of the culture. And the conflicts that arise in the area of free speech and religious liberty, I believe, derive from the dominant culture trying to adjust or to not adjust to the cultural changes that have happened and that will inexorably continue to happen. And that's the lens that I think we need to view the cases that come up. Now, I'm not a scholar, I'm a practitioner. So I don't have the same, I'm not as versatile in talking about Supreme Court cases and doctrine. But I see the potential effects of them. And I see in recent cases that they are in reaction in part to cultural change. Now, if we look, for example, at the Hobby Lobby case, if we look, for example, at the Masterpiece Cake case, both of those cases have to do with sex. We don't like to talk about it. We don't like to think about it. But contraception happens to have to do with sex. And marriage, same-sex marriage, or domestic partnerships happen to have to do with sex. When we were planning the argument on the domestic partners law in Wisconsin, I wanted, as part of our argument, to point out that domestic partnerships weren't substantially similar to marriage because in Wisconsin, the only everyone who's an adult can have sexual relations with any other consenting adult in private, as long as they're of age, except for one group of people, people who are married, because they are subject to the criminal law. If you commit adultery, it's still a felony in Wisconsin. I was persuaded not to make that argument. And part of the reason is because it was about sex. And so what I see happening is the dominant culture and the dominant religions are troubled about that issue and troubled about the vast cultural changes that have arisen with regard to sexual behavior and sexual mores. And that's how I view the lens of what, I use that lens to look at these cases. So I just want to put that out there for you as something to think about when you think about why was it that a sexual issue was fundamental in the Hobby Lobby case. Why is it that a sexual issue is fundamental in the Masterpiece Cake Theater? And when you start to think about those things, you begin to understand how we use the courts and how the courts interact with cultural change, and how you want the courts to interact with cultural change. In 12 minutes, I can't really go into what I think about that in great specifics, but I want that to be a part of your thinking. You know, why are cases coming up where people feel that they have to defend their religious beliefs? Why is it that a corporation now has religious beliefs? And in what context does that arise? Now, what that leads me to worry about is this. Rick had that excellent quote that freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction, from Ronald Reagan. I usually don't quote Ronald Reagan, okay? He seemed like a nice guy, and I liked Bedtime for Bonzo, but he's right. He was right. Absolutely right. The issue that I think that we face is this. Democracy is very, very fragile. The biggest enemy of democracy in the world today is theocracy. If we look at Iran, for example, which has a long and rich culture, that culture is suppressed by a theocratic regime. And we have to guard against theocracy. We have to guard against a dominant religion taking over the making of public policy, not just through the legislature, but through the courts. Now, I'm not suggesting that has occurred, but I am suggesting that it can occur. Because every single thing in constitutional law is subject to the final interpretation by the Supreme Court of the United States. And we, I think, as lawyers and as citizens, believe that the court will be careful and consistent and will follow precedent and so forth. But the danger is that when we can start down a slippery slope with that court. I gave a talk last year in Milwaukee, and I pointed, this was to the men's club of the Jewish community center in Milwaukee, and I said, you know, Jewish people in America have had great, great protection. And primarily the protection has come from the First Amendment and the First Amendment, through its incorporation through the 14th Amendment. And I said to them, that protection can go away if the Supreme Court of the United States interprets it away. And so I want us to be vigilant about that issue, to be careful as we think about issues of religious liberty and free speech. And, you know...
Lester, 1 minute.
Okay. And the where I come from, that is intellectually, is that we have to be vigilant in the protection of minorities. It's interesting, as Rick said, that people in Green Bay say they're afraid to speak their minds. Part of the reason that people are afraid to speak their minds is because they're afraid that people will speak back to them. And they won't. They don't like what they hear. It's not a matter of suppression of speech. It's a matter of being uncomfortable with speaking because somebody else disagrees. But that's the essence of free speech. And to come back to what I started out talking about, with the cultural changes that have occurred over the last 70 years, that there are more people who are speaking up than there ever have been before. There are more avenues for them to speak. And so the issues of free speech are more and more important, but the personal interactions with regard to free speech become more and more fraught. And we need to all think about that as we're approaching free speech and freedom of religion issues. Thank you.
Thank you so much for those remarks. Our final speaker today is Jordan Lawrence, who serves as senior counsel with Alliance Defending Freedom, where he plays a key role with the advocacy research and innovation team. His work encompasses a broad range of litigation with a primary focus on religious liberty, freedom of speech, student privacy, conscious rights of creative professionals, and the First Amendment freedoms of public university students and professors. He has presented arguments on these topics in courts around the country, including in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. Thank you for being here, Jordan.
It's a pleasure to be here. I'm from Minnesota. I grew up in Minnesota. I hope you won't hold that against me. My one case that I argued at the Supreme Court was against the University of Wisconsin in the Southworth case I argued it in 1999. And the guy sitting next to me was Associate Justice Dan Kelly, who was in private practice at that time, and who gave me all the intellectual heft I needed to argue that case. And you are very blessed to have such a great mind sitting on the highest court, and the governor needs to be commended for appointing him there. So I just point that, give the shout out to Dan. So I now live in the Washington, D.C. area, and for the last 7 years, I've been basically focusing on U.S. Supreme Court cases. And they've included, so sometimes you have a guy that argues a case, but you usually have this team of attorneys that are arguing the cases. And ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom, we have had 9 cases in the past 7 years up there. We've had 3 in the last 11 months, including the Masterpiece Cake Shop and the NIFLA case. And I also worked on Hobby Lobby, and I'm feeling like one of those Sherpa guides in Nepal that keep taking people up to the top of Mount Everest, which they do in May. If you don't, that's the you go up to Mount Everest in May. It's right before the monsoon season, so this is appropriate that we're talking about this with Lester, and maybe he can clarify when he's. I felt like I was agreeing with a lot of what he was saying. If I define the religious minorities being oppressed by the predominant orthodoxy, the prevailing orthodoxy, as the conservative Catholics, Mormons, Christians that are seeing the prevailing orthodoxy of more of a liberal secularism, a rejection of traditional sexual mores, trying to misuse the government power to oppress them. And I'm not quite sure if that's what he was saying or not. But if that's what he meant, I totally agree with him, because that's exactly what's going on. And the beauty of the First Amendment is that it protects minority points of views, that when the drafters of the First Amendment, the first Congress, I think had a basic understanding that when people get into government, there is this corrupting temptation to censor people you don't agree with and force people to basically pledge allegiance to the prevailing orthodoxy, kind of a Barnett type way. And that's what we have both in the Cake Baker case and in the NIFLA case on the abortion funding. It's the attempt of the prevailing orthodoxy to force its will on the dissenters, who I think are dwindling in their popularity of their points of view. And it's I think in no way the prevailing orthodoxy is kind of a 1950s sexuality. I wasn't going to speak about Hobby Lobby, but one of the things is that these kind of disputes didn't come up before Obamacare, because there was no regulation, there was no government compulsion being put upon that. So in Hobby Lobby, what we had was an Obamacare regulation that was done by a bunch of administrative, in the administration. It wasn't part of the actual statute, that had at least three huge exemptions. They totally exempted churches as religious organizations. They exempted any employer who had 50 or fewer employees from the abortion pill mandate. And they also exempted those who were grandfathered in. So for this compelling governmental interest of having women having access to contraception, the federal government under the Obama administration exempted tens of millions of women employees, which just showed that there was some problem with how this was going on. So I think that this shows more of trying to target those that don't agree. And then especially after they went for Little Sisters of the Poor a couple of years later, that just shows that this was not trying to make widespread availability of contraception, which could have been done much easier in different ways, rather than force dissenters to do it. And I think it shows this kind of thing that we're seeing in the Barnett case is getting everybody, the dissenters, to toe the line by speaking what the government says. Now, in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, with a lot of these others, this is where, as we've seen Obergefell and the legalization of same-sex marriage, that we've seen these come up in these contexts of these expressive businesses. So there are some businesses that produce expression as the way they make their profit. Steven Spielberg's movie The Post shows that the Washington Post and the New York Times won their freedom of speech case with the Pentagon Papers by saying this is a prior restraint under the First Amendment. The fact that they were a corporation didn't stop them. The fact that they were trying to earn money or earn a profit didn't stop them. The Supreme Court didn't say, if only you were a hippie newspaper handed out for free on the streets of Haight-Ashbury, then you'd have a First Amendment right. They didn't say that. They said it was protected because of the nature of the expression. And you begin to think that there's a number of occupations that what they do is they produce custom-made expression. Videographers, website designers, people who ghostwrite books, people who translate books, people who set up advertising campaigns, tattoo artists. And they can be asked that they make custom products. And you can imagine somebody coming in and saying, I want you to design a website or design a tattoo that expresses this. And the person who creates it saying, I have a conscientious objection against this. So, you know, for example, if you had a vegan new age website designer and the local Santeria church came in and said, will you design a website, you know, emphasizing our rituals of sacrificing animals for our gods, you could see where the website designer might have a conscientious objection to that. And the answer would be, why don't you find somebody else to design it? Not, let's take you down to the Madison Human Rights Commission and sue you for religious discrimination. Same way, what if it was a veterans group that wanted a website celebrating their reunion for fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan? The website designer might have an objection to promoting the military, but that would not be discrimination by a public accommodation and veteran status. I mean, it might be technically, but I think that that's not the resolve it, the way to resolve it. And to single out these kinds of people, I just think is a misuse of the anti-discrimination laws as applied to those kinds of situations. Now, Jack Phillips is probably the only cake baker in all of Colorado that objects to making a same-sex a wedding cake for a designer wedding cake for a same-sex wedding. Jack Phillips serves all people, but he does not create all expression. And cakes express things. Walmart has been confronted with people wanting Confederate flag sheet cakes that they've said, well, we don't know if we can good conscience do that. And so cakes can communicate message. A wedding cake is a crucial prop used at wedding receptions. It's not part of the wedding ceremony, but the couple walks in, they cut this multi-tiered cake, they feed each other, and people applaud and let the celebration begin. And it communicates, we are now legitimately married. And what this couple wanted was a cake. They wanted rainbow batter inside. They didn't tell that to Jack Phillips until after he said no to them. But they understood this communicative part that the cake plays, that they didn't want a pizza to cut, they didn't want a pot roast, they didn't want a birthday cake, they want a multi-tiered wedding cake that when it was cut had rainbow batter to reveal that same-sex couples could be just as legitimately married. Now, up until Obergefell, these kind of cases didn't exist. So the extension of the government powers what created, just like in the Obamacare case with Hobby Lobby, created the conscience conflict. And that's why the First Amendment is there to resolve it. We argued that case back on December 5th. We'll probably get a decision sometime before the end of the year. They got about 40 cases left for the next six weeks or so to the end of the term. Now, we also argued the NIFLA case on March 20th. And this is an even more blatant example of government coercion of a prevailing orthodoxy to force in this kind of Pledge of Allegiance Barnett way the dissenters to assert the statements of the political orthodoxy. I'm just, now there's a lot I could say about that case, but let me just focus on the main part. The California legislature passed the California Reproductive Fact Act, and they basically gerrymandered this so that the legal requirement would only apply to about the 200 or so pro-life help centers that basically give their services for free to urge women not to have abortions. Some of them have medical licenses so they can do medical procedures. Usually the only medical procedure they did was ultrasound or pregnancy tests. So these were not signs that said, here are the inherent dangers of or risks involved in getting a pregnancy test or getting an ultrasound. They had this statement. This is what they had to post. California has public programs that provide immediate, free, or low-cost access to comprehensive family planning services, including all FDA-approved methods of contraception, prenatal care, and abortion for eligible women. To find out more, call this certain number. Now, they exempted all for-profit medical providers, all medical providers who did not see pregnant women as the primary point of their medical practice. So that was just one of their secondary things. They were exempt from posting these signs, as well as they exempted any that signed up for another California program that basically required you to dispense abortifacient drugs. So guess who's in the remainder set? About 200 pro-life organizations. Then they, if there was any advertising that these groups or the non-medical ones do, they had to put them in various languages. So even if you had the Justice Sotomayor asked, so if they had pro-life as their advertisement, they would have to put disclaimers if they were not medically licensed in up to 13 languages, even if the original one wasn't in any of those languages, to basically make the advertising untenable. Now, California.
One minute.
California didn't advertise this on the internet, the radio, TV. This was the only way that they communicated these messages. So to me, this is exactly the type of thing we were trying to, that the Supreme Court noted in West Virginia Barnett, that the First Amendment protects the minority viewpoint from being crushed and silenced by the prevailing orthodoxy of sexual freedom that we're having now. It was anti-Nazism or anti-communism. That's, now it's the orthodoxy of sexual freedom, or to force them to say things that show their, that basically show them pledging allegiance to this new orthodoxy. And I hope the Supreme Court in both those cases by the end of June will carve out that protection of freedom and protect them. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jordan. Now we're going to have give the panelists an opportunity to respond to what the other panelists said. Maybe we can start with Lester, because Jordan specifically asked him a question or an implication about what he had said, and then we can just kind of go back.
Well, I actually had a couple of questions, because I was unclear about a couple of things that you said, and that is, what was my understanding of abortion pill is it's a combination of mifepristone and misoprostol for medication abortions. And was that the abortion pill mandate that you're talking about in the Hobby Lobby case? Is that what, the drug you were talking about?
I thought there would be no science in this. We'd just be talking about constitutional law. Those are the, I don't remember the exact drugs, but they objected to those were ones that they would be required to dispense, both Hobby Lobby and the Little Sisters of the Poor. There's obviously a dispute over whether those actually create abortions, but this was their belief from the science that they based it on, that it disrupted implantation, so therefore it was an abortifacient.
I'm just curious about that. I just never heard about the abortion pill. I mean, the only abortion pill is that it's for medication abortion, so I wasn't sure what you were talking about. But interestingly, one of the things that on this the California case with regard to the crisis pregnancy centers, and this interacts with the question of whether or not the state has a right to guard against fraud, and that's then you have there then that presents a conflict, you know, about speech and state regulation. So the question, I think, that's raised in that regulation, you argued it, I didn't. But I think that an issue in those regulations is whether or not the pregnancy centers were actually being fraudulent in inducing women to come in with the idea that they were getting something more comprehensive than they were. But I'm just pointing that out to say that's a conflict. Okay, to characterize it as that there is a prevailing orthodoxy that's being imposed, I think is a bit hyperbolic. The notion that Christianity or conservative Christianity is under attack is really hard to swallow. There are certainly currents in the culture where people do not agree with the tenets of conservative Christianity. But when I drive from here to Green Bay and I drive through Winnebago County, I see gigantic churches that are brand new, that are evangelical churches. They don't seem to be suffering. And I think that's the idea that the dominant religion in America is being oppressed is a frame which is not an accurate frame, and which would lead to bad results in court cases if that is what the argument is based on. But I will agree that with the Obergefell case and laws which have been passed to protect gay and lesbian people from discrimination, that it has caused conflict. And I expect that the court is going to resolve the Masterpiece Cake case in favor of the cake maker. I fully expect that. The question then is this. There were times when the cake maker wouldn't have made a cake for an interracial couple, because the cake maker, perhaps, would have had sincerely held religious beliefs that that people of different races should not marry. We would not accept that today. The Supreme Court in Hobby Lobby suggested that that the decision in Hobby Lobby shouldn't be read at all to suggest that you could have that kind of distinction. Race distinction, you know, racial discrimination is off the table. It was off the table, but that wasn't off the table 60 years ago. Some of those things were religiously based. And that is some of the objection to, or some of the support for segregation, some of the objection to desegregation, and certainly objection to interracial marriage, was in part religiously based. And I'm just suggesting that, and that's what I was trying to talk about in my talk, was that these changes in culture create these conflicts in the law, and that we have to be careful about what we do in these cases, because we don't want religious freedom issues to then become the dominant way and the dominant frame in which we look at legal decisions and how that's going to affect people's behavior.
Jordan, do you want to take a response to that?
Yeah, there's so much there to say. I hear this thing like, well, you know, I drive around and I see all these big churches, and so therefore there must be religious liberty. Well, that's an undeniable fact. But I think that that's sort of missing the point. So let me give you two examples. Yesterday, Amazon announced that Alliance Defending Freedom could no longer be part of the Amazon Smiles program. So we were singled out as an organization, and they related it to the false statements by the Southern Poverty Law Center that we're a hate group, that sort of thing. So the fact that coexists with the fact that there's these big churches on the way to here to Green Bay, and the fact that we haven't got to the status of North Korea yet doesn't mean that there's some cultural infringement on religious liberty. Now, here at the University of Wisconsin, Steve,
maybe they don't like what you say, and they're a corporation,
right? Okay,
right? And so the corporations now have the right to free speech. They can certainly do this and do that.
Then let's talk about the University of Wisconsin.
We don't like this guy.
Okay, so the University of Wisconsin, we filed, Dan Kelly and I filed this lawsuit. They say they can require students to give the money out because they're going to dispense the money even-handedly to groups. Then a few years later, the University of Wisconsin says, even though we're mandating students to pay the fee, we will not give money to religious groups who engage in religious worship. And so it was the Roman Catholic Foundation that became Badger Catholic was denied funding. And we had to have the Seventh Circuit reverse that. So there's, again, this kind of singling out the religious groups for treatment worse than everybody else with that type of going on. Now, Jack Phillips is facing real consequences for violating the Clinic Act. They can be fined up to $200 a thing. Now, let me read the statement, too, if you think it's a neutral statement. California's public programs provide medium, free, or low-cost access to comprehensive family planning services, including all FDA-approved methods of contraception, prenatal care, and abortion. Most women in the Medi-Cal program pays for the main way that women terminate their pregnancies, and that is by giving birth. And they don't even list it here in the thing. So they don't say, hey, do you realize the state would pay for you to give birth to your child? So this is an ideologically slanted statement that they're requiring these pro-life centers to say. And the Supreme Court pointed this out. And I would just say, if this is just delusional, that all these Christians and pro-lifers are suffering persecution and we're just in some sort of Fox News echo chamber or something like that, then why is the Supreme Court giving such credence to what we're saying? I mean, Justice Kennedy, I mean, even Sotomayor and Ginsburg were saying, this seems like a little much in this case. So I feel like the reality, I would just urge you to see that there's the those that control the main parts of the culture that are the voices. There may be a lot more numbers that, you know, go and elect Trump and, you know, Wisconsin goes red instead of blue, you know, that kind of thing. But the people that control the opinion makers, the people with the megaphones, certainly are not espousing conservative Christian pro-life views in this society.
Professor,
can I jump in here a little? Yeah. A few of the things in this past exchange that Mr. Lawrence has said struck me as almost bizarre, honestly. Although I understand what he's saying. I'm not sure about the constitutional significance of the people who hold the megaphones. I'm just not sure that the Constitution provides a remedy for a culture, and that there's a culture, a constitutional requirement to adjust the culture in some way. That's a very broad observation. I'm just not sure what to do with it. It just strikes me as confusing. But let me go back to the Masterpiece case, not in terms of this discussion that these two gentlemen are having about, is there a war against Christmas? I have to confess, I've yet to meet a non-Christian who finds the suggestion that conservative Christians are oppressed minorities anything other than a joke. It's a victimization that exists, that is only recognizable by members of the self-proclaimed group, which may or may not be interesting, but it's at least suggestive of something. But let me go back to this particular case, not in terms of that debate, but in terms of what I was talking about earlier about categories, right? In order to make these arguments work, we have to abandon some of our previously existing First Amendment categories. And maybe that's a good thing, but we should recognize that we are abandoning them. So, for example, in 1965, there was Piggy Park. Piggy Park was a barbecue shop whose owner said that serving black and white customers together sent the message that he approved of race mixing, and that violated his rights against compelled speech and his religious objections. In 1965, the Supreme Court dismissed that, basically left it out of court. I believe the phrase was, this is not a serious argument. Today, apparently it is. In fact, one of the lawyers, I don't know if it was Mr. Lawrence or someone else, when confronted with a question about race discrimination in the Supreme Court argument, said, well, that might be a unique case. Well, perhaps so. That might be a debate. I mean, there might be a reason to argue that race is unique and all other forms of discrimination are different, but it would be a new approach. It would be a new argument, a different argument. Traditionally, in the case of expressive conduct, we've said that expressive conduct occurs only when a neutral observer would plausibly associate the expression with the person who performed the conduct. And so by that traditional measure, we would ask, is seeing a cake at a wedding, if you see this cake at a wedding, would you say, aha, that baker approves of same-sex marriage? It's an empirical fact question to be decided at trial, but traditionally that would be one of the tests. If we're abandoning that test, we may. We may say that expressive conduct is the same as speech in the context of compelled expression, and abandon that old distinction between attributable expressive conduct and non-attributable expressive conduct. But it's new, and that's just interesting, and of course it raises new conundra and new questions. So my only point is not that it's obviously wrong, but it is much more radical than we seem to be giving credit to in the debates that we're having. And as always, when we make radical changes in the intellectual vocabulary that we employ to ask certain categories of question, we should think about the consequences that will lead to beyond just the question before us, being driven by the facts of an individual case is almost never, hard cases make bad law, as the fellow once said, and he was pretty smart.
Professor Essenberg?
Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, Lester asked why these people in Green Bay would think that they are not free to speak, and suggested it's because they're afraid that someone will speak back to them. Now, I would note, and without further comment, that many of the people who attended this event that we held in Green Bay with David French, and who felt that they would be subject to unacceptable sanction if they spoke freely, actually came from Madison.
And your point is?
The problem is, Lester asked, well, why would these people think that they have to defend their religious expression? And the reason is that they are the ones who are facing coercion. That is, you know, I don't subscribe to the notion that, you know, that Christianity is under some wholesale attack. But there are certain elements of the Christian community who are essentially being told that your point of view reads you out of polite society in some way. And the reason that these cases are coming down the way they are, high on Hobby Lobby, in the California case, in the Masterpiece Baker case, it's not that these folks who have brought these cases are attempting to impose their views on others. They're not. They're the ones who are attempting to defend themselves against imposition or restriction of their ability to express their views. So, you know, the Democrats are fond of saying, or the progressive left is fond of saying, that we represent the coalition of the ascendant, and maybe that will turn out to be true. I don't think history has any arc. But if it is true, then there ought not to be any reason to help history along through legal coercion. Now, when we talk about the impact of the culture, and Professor Schreber says, well, we can't do anything about the culture. There's no constitutional right to change the culture. And I agree with that. But I think there is a constitutional right to be able to stand against it. In 1942, the culture said that we must all unify, we must all pledge allegiance to the flag, because right. We face an existential enemy. But yet, the United States Supreme Court carved out a space for the exercise of freedom of conscience, even in the face of that type of threat. There will always be a reason to suppress freedom of speech. There will always be a reason to suppress freedom of conscience. Popular speech, popular manifestations of conscience, they don't need protection. Nobody will ever attempt to do anything for them. This only gets hard, and this only gets to be a principle that we have to stand for when there's conflict. And when, there's the famous saying that, you know, I will defend, I disagree with what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. Well, we say that, we express our agreement with that, but then we find it hard to cash out. We find it hard to live up to that in practice. And what the Supreme Court did in Barnett is it held us to that standard. It said, this is what we believe, and we're gonna stick to it. I think the notion that that baking a cake is not expressive conduct because someone else will not believe that you expressed yourself is not consistent with our constitutional jurisprudence, and it's not consistent with a common understanding of what expression means. You know, in the Trump inaugural, there are a lot of dress designers that said that they wouldn't dress Ivanka Trump, right. because they understood what they were doing to be creative expression. And you know what? I think they had an absolute right. They had an absolute right to refuse to do that. It's absolutely true that Amazon can refuse to allow into their Smiles program anyone they want. As a matter of legal doctrine, we don't apply First Amendment principles against private corporations, and I don't think we should unless they promise to abide by them. But I think that... I'm sorry. But I do think it's important, if not as a matter of law, but as a matter of civil peace, that we recognize that although we have the right to boycott people, although Google has the right to fire people that write memos expressing opinions that they don't like, Google ought not do that. That we ought to actually have a culture of tolerance, and we also have a culture in which we're able to interact with people with which we disagree, even when what they say is something that we strenuously disagree with. In all of these conversations, there's always sort of the Loving versus Virginia card is played, but the problem here, I think, is that the fact that you can find some similarity between two things doesn't mean that they are in fact similar. I do believe that race is.
It was an expression. It was service. Although you put in that he would be expressing.
He said the
act of serving black people was against his religious belief.
That's right.
And I think Jack Phillips, for example, I defended the New Mexico photographer. They serve all people. There's nothing expressive about serving barbecue. And I think to conflate that, I think the example, if I can just interject, is the Hurley St. Patrick's Day parade case in 1995. You kind of gloss over that, where they viewed the Massachusetts authority and the state Supreme Court found it to be the parade put on by a veterans group to be a public accommodation. And they said, but because their product was essentially expressive, it was compelled speech to use their anti-discrimination law to force them to include a message they would not otherwise do voluntarily. So that's over 20 years old. I think we're relying on cases like that. And that to me is exactly the kind of argument we're making in the Jack Phillips case, not some sort of concocted new legal theory.
If you want to make that argument, recognize that Hurley depended entirely on the claim that the message would be ascribed to the parade organizer.
No, it did not. That is clearly not the case. And I would point out to the Supreme Court said the fact that people would know it wasn't their message does not exonerate them from the First Amendment compelled speech violation. And they pointed to Tornillo and Woolley versus Maynard to point out that was the case. So I just think, with all due respect, Professor, I think you're just wrong on that point of law, that if people can't attribute it to you, you're off the hook. Nobody thinks that a New Hampshire license plate is the message of the car driver, or that somebody responding under the Florida law is the opinion of the Miami Herald. So the fact that you can't attribute it is not exonerate these kinds of situations.
You know, my concern is that the expressive speech concept is going to expand. That's the danger. If you're right about the cake maker, okay, and you may be right, because the Supreme Court decides what's right and what's wrong. That's why they're called the Supreme Court. There's no appeal from there. You may be right. Then the next expressive, speech is the hairdresser who does a certain hairstyle, and the nail salon that does a certain nail, or the tailor who makes a certain suit, or the car detailer who puts a certain detail. And there's a slippery slope here toward the concept of using expressive speech to discriminate against a minority that you don't like. That's a danger.
Gentlemen, we're at our stop point, and I think, you know, while people are, I'm sure, loving this conversation, people love to eat lunch, so we're going to have to give Lester the last word on that. Even though we're at the time? Okay. I've been given privileges by Lisa to do a couple of questions, so please make your way up to the microphone.
I'm just turning the mic on.
Yeah, when you're taking the pictures, you know, that's expressive.
Since we have no
questions. It is. That's what we argued in the New Mexico photographer case.
If you could. Okay.
Come with the microphone.
Yeah, I'm.
Go ahead. I think Rick should be allowed to have the last word.
Okay.
Could you call my wife afterwards and tell her that? So here's the thing. We always hear the slippery slope argument, but I do not believe that we live life on a slip and slide. It's an argument that itself is the ultimate slippery slope because there's no stopping point to it. And here's the thing that I would point out. Howard mentioned, and I actually think that the points he made about the way in which our religion clause jurisprudence has changed is a very good one. But in Employment Division versus Smith, the United States Supreme Court refused to apply strict scrutiny to all laws which burden religious practice. And I think part of the reason, and particularly if we look at the academic commentary on it, the problem here, and it's a real problem, is that religion is limited only by the human imagination, and that anybody can claim that anything is an exercise of their religious practice. But in Wisconsin, we don't follow Employment Division versus Smith. In interpreting Article 1, Section 18 of the Wisconsin Constitution, we say, yeah, if there's a substantial burden on religious practice, that has to be justified by strict scrutiny. And that decision is now almost 25 years old. And we have not been inundated with claims that religion justifies all manners of exemption from secular regulation. It simply hasn't happened.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Do you make a distinction between religious practice and sincerely held religious belief?
Do I make a distinction between religious practice and sincerely held religious belief? If the point that you're trying to make is, under what circumstances can a court evaluate whether a religious belief is sincerely held, then we're getting into a whole other question that we can't possibly discuss before lunch.
That's not my question. My question is, the references to a case which said we apply strict scrutiny to the interference with a religious practice. And what I'm asking is, does that mean the same thing as does religious practice mean the same thing as a religious belief?
Well, a religious practice is typically predicated upon a religious belief. In the case in which the Wisconsin Supreme Court announced that it would not follow Miller, we had a religious practice. We had the Amish saying that they did not, that their religion prohibited them from having, one of those orange slow-moving vehicle signs on the back of their buggies. And so they claimed the right to be exempt from that. I would call that a religious practice based upon a religious belief. Well, I don't remember enough about the Amish to know precisely what the religious belief they had, which allowed them to, or which caused them not to have that belief. It was something about gaudy symbols or something like
promoting
that.
Promoting pride.
Right.
I just want to comment that I agree with, I think, every single thing that Rick just said, which is not, does not always happen.
And that's a great way to end a
Right.